chapter 2, if you will find that with us, and it will show up on the screen once I actually connect. So I did a little too much visiting this morning, I guess, and not enough getting my stuff prepped here. So we left off in the middle of chapter 2 last week. We talked about the spies, and we left off talking about the surprise. The surprise was in verse 9. This was after Rahab had hid the men on the roof and then told the king's messengers, if you hurry, you might still be able to catch them. Verse 9, she said to the men, I know that the Lord hath given you the land, and that your terror is fallen upon us, that all the inhabitants of the land faint because of you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did unto the two kings of the Amorites that were on the other side of Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we had heard these things, our hearts did melt, neither did there remain any more courage in any man because of you, for the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above, and in earth beneath. Don't think that's what they were expecting to hear from the inhabitants of Jericho. That was a surprise. It's interesting there, verse 9, your terror is fallen upon us. Verse 11, it says, our hearts did melt. You know, those are, particularly the second phrase, very picturesque. But if resolve and courage and determination is pictured as firmness, okay, well then hearts did melt is the opposite of that. Okay, you ever had to do something that you were very uncomfortable with, and rather than being firm and confident, you were unsteady, trembly, maybe hands shaking, maybe knees wobbling, maybe both at the same time? You know, where sometimes I sit on the platform, so I get to see, you know, what folks don't always. So sometimes the singers will afterwards say, could you see my knees knocking? I'm like, no, I wasn't looking at your knees, you know. But, you know, there's, you know, that unsteadiness is kind of the opposite. But our hearts did melt. You ever just had that sinking feeling like, oh, it's done. This is not going to work. This all just blew up. You know, that's one way that I picture that, but they were expecting a far different result, I think. However, God, through Moses, had told them that this is what they should expect. Deuteronomy chapter 2, verse 25, this day will I begin to put the dread of thee and the fear of thee upon the nations that are under the whole heaven, who shall hear report of thee and shall tremble and shall be in anguish because of thee. That kind of sounds like God told him that's exactly what he was going to do, doesn't it? Deuteronomy 11, verse 25, there shall no man be able to stand before you. The Lord your God shall lay the fear of you and the dread of you upon the land that you shall tread upon. Well, what you see here in Joshua chapter 2 is that very thing had happened. They'd heard about the Red Sea. They'd heard about some of the other things. And then they heard about Sihon and Og, who were their neighbors just on the east side of the Jordan. But the Amorites are mentioned many times in the Pentateuch and historical books as long-term residents of the land of Canaan. But I do think it was a surprise, just simply because I think human nature kind of kicked in. And yeah, you know, the Lord said he was going to do this, but oh, wow, look, it really happened. You know, we're guilty of the same thing sometimes, aren't we? And so they were not at all expecting to hear that kind of thing out of the mouth of Rahab, I don't think. But then that moves us to a solicitation or a request in verse number 12. Now therefore I pray you, swear unto me by the Lord, since I have showed you kindness, that you will also show kindness unto my father's house and give me a true token, and that you will save alive my father, my mother, my brethren, my sisters, and all that they have, and deliver our lives from death. So that's the request. Is that a fair trade? I think so. I spared your life. Now I'm asking you to spare mine. You know, that seems like a fair trade. And it's a reasonable request. Now, it's interesting there in verse 12, now therefore I pray you, swear unto me by who? What's the name that's given there in verse 12? Swear unto me by the Lord. That name wasn't given to be used until the burning bush, Exodus chapter 3, right? So it's interesting to me that at this point they had heard of the name of the Lord, Jehovah, I am that I am. They had heard of that, and she said, look, I want you to swear by your God that you will do this. I mean, that was their mindset. In essence, that request is calling God as a witness. You know, God is the witness to this agreement that we're making, and if you break it, he is also the judge to bring about the consequences if you don't keep your commitment. So her request is, I saved your life, you save my life and that of my family. Well, you have the solution then in verses 14 through 20. The men answered her, our life for yours, if ye utter not this our business. And that's a reasonable condition, I think. Okay, as long as you keep your mouth shut, we'll agree to this deal. Our life for yours, if you utter not this our business. And it shall be, when the Lord hath given us the land, that we will deal kindly and truly with thee. Then she let them down by a cord through the window, for her house was upon the town wall, and she dwelt upon the wall. And she said unto them, get you to the mountain, lest the pursuers meet you, and hide yourself there 3 days, until the pursuers be returned, and afterward may you go your way. So, you know, that here's the arrangement. She's like, all right, they said, we'll make a deal as long as you keep your mouth shut. Now, in verse 15, it says she lived on the wall. Now, so is this like a tent that's pitched on top of the wall? I mean, it sounds like if she went through the window and down the wall, it sounds like it was built into the wall, right? I mean, that seems to be the most logical explanation, that the dwelling place was built into the wall. And you say, well, how in the world does that look like? Well, I mean, if you take apartment buildings or row houses and tie enough of them together, you'd have the same thing on the backside, right? I mean, we do this, a similar concept at times. But it seems like her house was built into the city wall. So verse 15, she let them down by a cord through the window. We read about that a few times in the Bible, don't we? You think of anybody else in the Bible that was let down over the wall? Yeah, Paul, right? They put him in a basket and let him down over the city wall when he was being pursued. That probably happened another time or two, but that's the most familiar one that I could remember. But here the word cord, verse 15, she let them down by a cord through the window. Her house was upon the town wall. The word cord here is the normal word for rope. You know, this was used in 2 Samuel. The word was used where it says in 2 Samuel 17, they said, you know, if you go into the city, we're going to take ropes and we're going to pull down the city wall and we're going to find you there. It was used in different places in the Old Testament referring to the ships tackling and such, you know, the ropes for the sails, or sometimes they would use ropes to undergird the wooden structure of a boat if they thought they were going to get a real strong storm and they were trying to keep the wood from breaking apart. In Jeremiah, if you remember, at one point in time, one of the kings that Jeremiah prophesied to really didn't appreciate the fact that he said God's going to bring Jerusalem into captivity, and they threw him in jail. And then at one point they threw him in the bottom of a dry well, a dry cistern, and said, you're staying there until I return from the battle in peace to prove that you're a liar. Well, what happened? The king died in battle, just like Jeremiah said was going to happen. Well, then it says they let down ropes and they put rags under his armpits to kind of cushion it a little bit, and they pulled him up out of the bottom of the well with ropes. It's the same word. Okay, I'm saying that because there's a contrast here. In verse number 18, it says, bind this line of scarlet thread in the window. Okay, is it the same rope or was it a different rope? You know, not a huge deal in the grand scheme of things. Okay, but it is two different words here. So here you have the word for rope. You dropped a rope down the window, and they're climbing down. I don't know that they had rappelling gloves or harnesses, but you know, they climbed down the outside of the city wall using that rope. Okay, But then verse 16, she said unto them, get you to the mountain. What mountain? You ever look at the Bible lands map? I mean, the major mountains that we hear about in relation to the land of Israel are generally located where? Where was Mount Sinai? You know, way south in the Sinai Peninsula in the desert. Okay? Elijah and the prophets of Baal, that happened at Mount what? Mount Carmel. You know, that was in the north and near the Mediterranean. We also sometimes hear about mountains of Lebanon, again, in the far north on the border with what would be Syria. You know, those are the mountains that we're more familiar with. I mean, there was, you know, there were smaller hills, but I don't think that this was one of those major mountains. I think it was what we would call a hill. I mean, anybody from out west would call pretty much anything around here a hill. If they're more familiar with the Rocky Mountains and some of the larger ranges, right? But I mean, take for example, Crowder's Mountain. Is that a mountain or is that just a big hill? Perspective, I guess. You know, there's South Mountain. Is that a mountain? Is that a hill? You know, but anyway, I say that to say it, there was somewhere in the proximity of Jericho, the commentators that I tried to look it up said probably north of Jericho, north or north and west a little bit. There was hill country there. But basically, go the opposite way of the river. They think you're headed straight back to the river to cross the river and go back to your camp. So you go a different way and hide out in the mountain. It's not specified, which one. I don't think it's one of the major named ones that we're real familiar with. Get you to the mountain, lest the pursuers meet you, and hide yourself there 3 days until the pursuers be returned, and afterward may you go your way. That's kind of specific, isn't it? 3 days. Seems like she kind of knew their protocol. You know, it makes me wonder if this wasn't the first time they had suspected Israeli spies and they sent people out looking for them. But, she said, give it 3 days for it to calm down before you go back. So she did. Hide yourselves 3 days until the pursuers be returned, and afterwards go your way. Verse 17, the men said unto her, we will be blameless of this thine oath which thou hast made us to swear. Behold, when we are come into the land, thou shalt bind this line of scarlet thread in the window which thou didst let us down by. And thou shalt bring thy father, mother, and brethren, and thy father's household home unto thee. And it shall be that whosoever shall go out of the doors of thy house into the street, his blood shall be upon his head, and we will be guiltless. Whosoever shall be with thee in the house, his blood is on our head, if any hand be upon him. And if thou utter this our business, then we shall be quit of thine oath which thou hast made us to swear. I think that's reasonable conditions. I have no idea who your mama and your cousins and your nieces and nephews are. I mean, you all look like Jerichoites. That's not great English, but you all look like Canaanites to me. I don't know you. So here's the deal. Anybody that's inside your house, we're obligating ourselves to protect them. Anybody that's out wandering the streets, it's on them. I think that's a fair deal. And the only other condition was, again, they repeated, you don't say a word about this. Okay, deal. But there in verse 18, it says, bind this line of scarlet thread in the window which thou didst let us down by. Which thou didst let us down by. Is that talking about the rope or is that talking about the window? That's really the point of discussion, I think that I think you could make a valid argument for either one, okay? I think that it was more than likely not the same rope that went all the way down to the ground that they hung out the window, but there was a, because the word thread here is a different word. It's a completely different word. If you remember Samson, when Delilah had him and she's trying to get him to reveal his secrets, and at one point he said, if you get 7 brand new ropes that nobody's ever been bound with and you bind me with seven ropes, then I lose my strength. And so they did, and then she said, the Philistines are here, Samson, and the Bible says he broke them off as though it were thread. It's the same word here, thread. Okay, so it seems to me like what she was hanging out the window might have been a little different. It's also possible the word thread refers to the smaller strands that were braided together to make a thicker rope. You know, could have been that it was just maybe one strand of the rope and not the entire, you know, thick rope itself. But nonetheless, the fact that it's scarlet would have made it, you know, probably a little bit easier to recognize and maybe make it stand out a little bit. There's some that have made a connection there. What does the scarlet rope here mean? It means that she hung a red rope out the window. That's what it means. Now, can you use that as an illustration? I mean, scarlet, the color of blood, and you know, see how there was a you can make a connection, but be real careful if you do something like that to make sure that, all right, this is what it means, and this is what it reminds me of. You know, it doesn't mean that there was a blood sacrifice here, but you know, some have drawn that connection because of the scarlet cord and stuff, and you can make an analogy, but that's not the direct interpretation of the passage here. Just she hung a red rope out the window when they came back around. So you know, that was the arrangement. So they climb down the rope, and it almost seems like they're talking. You know, they're on the ground and she's at the window. They're kind of finalizing this deal before they leave. I don't know. You could read the description here a couple of different ways. But nonetheless, verse 20, if thou utter this our business, then we will be quit of thine oath which thou hast made us to swear. Verse 21, she said, according unto your words, so be it. And she sent them away, and they departed. And she bound the scarlet line in the window. Now, I'm curious. I mean, we're not given a specific timeline here. Did she do it that night? She tied it in there that night? It's possible. It's quite possible. I mean, if the city was, Israel hasn't crossed Jordan yet. But you remember, once they crossed Jordan, it says the city was shut up. Nobody went in or out. At this point, it wasn't like that. The spies got in and out. They're still opening the gates. I mean, I think if she hung it in the window now, it might have been kind of curious. I mean, if it was me, I'd wait till we hear that the Israelites are coming, then I'd hang it out the window. You know, but there are others that, if you aren't 2 weeks ahead of time, you're late, so they may have, you know, you may have hung it out now. You know, I could see it from both perspectives, but nonetheless, she kept up her end of the bargain. She marked the house clearly where they had agreed. Now, one of the favorite, you know, points of discussion here, I'm going to pull a Dr. Love and get into one of these discussions here a little bit. All right. Where are we going, Jim? Turn right. Okay, now, where do I go from here? No, Joshua did not have Google Maps. That's why they had to have the pillar of cloud. Whatever. All right. So one of the favorite points of discussion here is Rahab lied. You know, what about that? Rahab lied to the people. So was that right or wrong? All right, let me rewind a few years in the history of Israel. Pharaoh told the midwives, if it's a boy, you kill it. And they didn't because they feared God. And then when Pharaoh said, what are you doing? They said, well, you know, the Hebrew women are lively and, you know, their babies are already delivered before we ever get there to help them. Wasn't exactly true. They were doing that, though, because they feared God. They were trying to save life. But, you know, what I'm saying is there are those that are looking for any old excuse to justify, hey, look, Rahab lied and she got away with it, so I can lie. Really? What was Rahab's background? She's a pagan. She's hearing about the God of Israel through the news that travels, you know, back and forth. She's a pagan. She has decided, nope, their God's the real deal, and, you know, I want to be on the side of their God. She's made a personal choice that way, but, I mean, what's her background? I mean, she's introduced, you know, how many different times? And what was her occupation? Rahab the harlot. Okay? So, was she there at Mount Sinai? Has she heard the Ten Commandments? Has she heard the other 600 and some laws of Moses and those kind of things? No. So, you know, I think that there is a little bit, that doesn't mean that it was, if somebody is a heathen, then sin doesn't count. That's not what I'm saying, okay? But what I'm saying is there's a different level of accountability when you know. I mean, Moses didn't even lie. He just disobeyed God when he struck the rock. God judged him, right? He knew better. But is one of the Ten Commandments says, thou shalt not kill. Okay, well then David commanded certain ones at different times to be executed. So, you know, did he break that law? No. In fact, I find it interesting in 1 Kings chapter 2, it's actually David's laying on his deathbed. He's giving final instructions to Solomon. And he said, do not allow Joab to die in peace. But don't let his gray hairs go to the grave in peace. And the explanation that's given is this. In 1 Kings 2:5, it says that he shed the blood of war in time of peace. Specifically, he assassinated Abner because he didn't like him and he didn't trust him. They were not in battle. Okay, so there was a distinction made between a time of battle and, you know, a premeditated thing of what we would call murder or manslaughter in another context. You know, I think that there's other things that go on in the midst of war that are not exactly the same as peacetime, right? From Rahab's perspective, are they at war? Oh yeah, they're already at war. These people are coming, they're going to wipe us out and take our land, and we know it. So, I mean, she's operating on that basis. Any of you ever read the book, The Hiding Place, Corrie Ten Boom? Does that ring a bell? What about, you know, the people that hid the Jews from the Nazis that were trying to exterminate them? You know, we could go through and give other examples. So, was Rahab lying for personal gain? No, I don't think so. You know, I don't think that, you know, this is a matter of, I'm lying to get myself out of trouble. I'm lying to, you know, get something that I want. I think this is wartime, and she's trying to save life by what she did. You know, ultimately, Rahab was saved. This is my conclusion, and I'll give you a chance to comment on it here in a minute. But my conclusion is this: Rahab was saved because of her faith, not because of her lies. I think we can demonstrate that from the New Testament. So, you guys have any other thoughts on Rahab? And, you know, is this a template for, hey, it's okay to lie sometimes? If that's the case, then you better be in a situation where you actually fear for your life and you're in a, you know, a battlefield type situation and you're trying to save somebody's life. All right, then it's okay. Not just because I was afraid I was going to be in big trouble because, you know, I put a dent in the car. Any other thoughts or comments on that? Okay. Ask you when you're all kind of at that zoned out stage and don't get as many comments. But how many times do we see Rahab mentioned in the New Testament? Multiple times, right? In Matthew chapter 1 and verse number 5, we see her listed in the genealogies of Christ. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 31, we read her name listed in the Faith Hall of Fame. Interesting to me, we also read her name in the book of James. I mean, some of you were here when we went through that. It went through the book of James, but she was listed in the Faith Hall of Fame. Why? Well, I mean, right here she says, I know the Lord your God has given you the land and you're going to take us. And I know your God's in charge and I want to be on the side of your God. Doesn't that sound like faith? I mean, if she had been caught hiding the spies, she'd be tried for treason and executed, right? So, in essence, James holds up what Rahab did as an example of internal faith, which God could see, being evidenced by good works, which other people could see. The good works was not faith, but rather that was the fruit or the outworking of her faith was the good works that she did. She spared the lives of the spies, you know, as an evidence of the faith that she had already settled in her heart. I believe in the God of Israel. It's interesting. Rahab the harlot, but in the genealogy of Christ, in the Faith Hall of Fame, of all the examples that could have been given of faith being put to work, you get the example of Rahab in James chapter 2 in verse number 25. So, I mean, you think about it in that context. This is a city that, you know, has not known the God of heaven personally. And yet here's a woman who probably didn't have the best reputation in town anyway, who decides, nope, their God is the true God and what we've been doing is wrong, and I need to figure out how to get on the side of their God. That's what we would call a heathen or a pagan woman. You know, no prior relationship. Salvation's no respecter of persons, right? To the Jew first and also what? To the Greek. Go into all the world and preach the gospel to every nation. Okay? It wasn't like God was only interested in Israel and that was it. You see, over and over and over again, God wanted Israel to be the same thing that he told us in the New Testament, a light. You know, a city that's set on a hill cannot be hid. You don't hide a candle under a bushel, but you put it where it can be seen. He wanted them to be a light. He wanted them to be salt. He wanted others to be drawn to the God of Israel through their life and testimony and worship. I mean, even though God was dealing with Israel, salvation was not exclusive to Israel. That's what I'm trying to say here, okay? So, you have the deal made between the spies and Rahab. And then in the last part of chapter 2, we see the sharing. They go back and they share the news. Verse 21, they departed. Verse 22, they went and came unto the mountain and abode there 3 days until the pursuers were returned. And the pursuers sought them throughout all the way, but found them not. I mean, you ever imagine that scenario? Where are they? You didn't find them? You see the leader, whoever it is? Did you look over there? Did you check in the caves? You sure you walked behind all the trees? They couldn't have gotten away. They were in the dark. We know this country better than they do. The frustration had to be real because it was compounded with their fear. Verse 23. So the two men returned and descended from the mountain and passed over and came to Joshua the son of Nun and told him all the things that befell them. And they said unto Joshua, truly the Lord hath delivered into our hands all the land, for even all the inhabitants of the country do faint because of us. So you see with the spies, you see they're running to the hills, then they're returning to Joshua, and then their reports of their findings. You think Joshua already knew this? I think he did. I mean, he was closer than anyone else to Moses, right? He'd heard Moses say, God's going to put the fear of you and the dread of you, and he had seen the other battles in Sihon and Og and stuff. God has appeared to Joshua and said, the people listen to Moses, and I'm going to make sure they listen to you, and you're going to lead this people, be strong and have good courage. I mean, I think Joshua knew it. God is reinforcing this for Joshua, but I also think God did this partly for the people. When the spies go, I mean, it's one thing if Joshua says, all right, this is what we're going to do. I mean, it's another thing if I say, all right, Matt, you and Brother Harris, y'all go check it out and y'all come back. This is what I think. But they come back and they're like, man, you're not going to believe this. This is what happened to us and this is what we saw. And let me just tell you, they are scared to death. They are afraid of us and they're afraid of our God. I mean, what's that going to do for the people that hear that report? Okay, it's going to strengthen their faith. And you know, coming from, if I could say it this way, their colleagues sometimes has an added benefit that coming from leadership, not that coming from leadership is wrong, just coming from the colleagues sometimes hits a little differently, you know? And so they come back and they're telling this story and saying, hey, they're all scared. They've heard about this. And they've heard about Sihon and Og. And they know that God's given us the land. And, you know, I'm going to fill in my own thoughts here. But, hey, this might actually work. That's at least, you know, there were some of them that were like that.
I don't know about this.
I mean, yeah, we had Moses, but this Joshua, He's just a kid. I mean, he's 80 at this point, but, you know, he's just a kid. I don't know. Can we really trust all? You know, there's those kinds of people in every crowd. And so now they come back and they start telling, hey, she just came to us. We didn't prime the pump. She just came out and told us. They're all scared to death. Their hearts melted. They faint because of us. That's another way of saying, you know, a similar thing. But in other words, they're saying, look, God really is going to do what he told us he was going to do. Isn't that fun? When you kind of get, there's times when you have to take by faith what you don't see. And then there are other times when you start to see it falling into place. That's fun. When you kind of see, right, this is how it's all coming together. But they come back and they give a report. And if you see in chapter 3, verse 1, Joshua rose early in the morning and they removed from Shittim and came to Jordan. All right. So it seems like from a timeline perspective to me, pretty much as soon as the spies got back, remember we started out with Shittim. That was the location of the camp. That was just a 3 or 4 miles on the other side of the river, on the east side of the Jordan River. So the spies would have returned back to Shittim. They give the report, and it seems like the next day they moved down close to the river. And as we've already said, chapter 3, verse 2, came to pass after 3 days, officers went through the host and said, you know, here's the instruction. So they had been told at some point, get ready, in 3 days, we're going to be moving. So now, they are getting ready to move down. Of course, then in chapter 3, which we won't have time to get into all of this today, but in chapter 3, we have the passing over into the new land. So now it's all happening. For those of you that were here, do you remember when we first started talking about, you know, a merger? You know, and then we came over here and had a service, and then, you know, it's, well, this is going on and this is going on. You know, and then it's like, okay, we've got a moving date. We're moving on this day. And then it all kind of starts to become more real. Oh, this is actually happening, you know. That's what's going on in Israel right now. They send the spies over. The spies come back. They give the report. And Joshua's like, all right, it's time to move. And they move all the way down to the Jordan Valley right there. Probably within sight of the Jordan, at least from the front of the line. You know, if you've got 3 or 4 million people, the line's going to be far enough back. Maybe not everybody can see the river, especially because rivers tend to be in a low spot sometimes. But, you know, nonetheless, they're moving and they're getting ready to go. What you see here is even though Israel was flawed, okay, when God brought them out of Egypt, as soon as they got to the Red Sea and Pharaoh showed up, did they show faith or fear? Fear. Okay, they get across and the Red Sea, God drowns them, they have a big celebration, and then not too long after that, what happens? He brought us out here to die. There's no water, so you get the bitter water made sweet. He brought us out here to die, we got nothing to eat. God provides manna. You know, over and over and over again, there was the complaints. Well, after a year, God brings them up to the edge of the land the first time. The 12 spies go in and they, you know, bring back, the majority report was negative. What I'm saying is God promised he was going to bring Israel into the land, and Israel was anything but model in their behavior. You know, they doubted God at every turn. They were disobedient. They were whiners. They were self-willed. And yet, what is God doing? He brought them back to the land, and he's going to take them across, and he's going to give them the land just like he said he would. That's not a justification for disobedience. What I'm simply saying is that God is merciful. Okay? I think it's Psalm 103, but Psalms, it says, he knows our frame. He remembers that we're dust. We got Psalm 103 about verse 12 or 13. He knows what we're made of. But here, God has taken this whining, unbelieving, pain in the neck group of people, put up with them, taken care of them, and now he's brought them to the Jordan River. And of course, we know the story from Joshua chapter 3. He's getting ready to do a miracle for them and take them across and then do additional miracles in knocking down the walls and giving them the land. Here's what I'm saying. Sometimes, you know, our flesh or our enemy will convince us, well, you've messed up, God's done with you. If you're willing to confess and return to the Lord, God's not done with you. Okay? Number two, sometimes, you know, we forget the steps of growth that it took us to get from where we got saved to 20, 30, 40, however many years down the road now, and maybe think, look at somebody and think, I don't know if they'll ever make it. Well, that was us at one point in time probably, right? And so, you know, don't forget that God takes the babes, so to speak, and brings them along too. It's not just the, you know, more mature, developed ones that God blesses and uses. And so now we get to some of the fun part. You've seen some of the hard part. Now as we go into Joshua chapter 3, 4, and 5, we get to see some of the victories and some of the fun things. And we'll pick up there, Lord willing, next time. Let's close in a word of prayer. Thank you, Lord, for your word. Thank you that you keep your promises regardless of our faith or our fear. And Lord, I pray that you'd help us to be people of faith, to have our faith strengthened as a result of the things that we see in your word. And Lord, I pray that your blessing will be upon the service to come now in every aspect.